When people have successful careers, it's very rarely a linear up and to the right. Sometimes it is, but the most like breakout careers, they have inflection points where things are going linearly, but then they get like a real change in their trajectory because it's usually because they've done something exceptional or unusual. So just always be like attentive to that. Like, what is going to be your breakout moment?
Welcome to Secrets of the City, the show where we uncover the stories behind the people who work in the highly lucrative yet enigmatic jobs of the City of London. I'm your host, Ayush Santalia.
And on the show today, we speak to Imran Mahmood. Imran initially was training to be a doctor. He spent 6 years studying medicine at Oxford and then did 2 further years of internship training, which in the UK we call foundation training. He then took a gap year and got funding from the Fulbright Commission to go back to university, this time in the US, where he studied for a Master's in Public Health and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health. After coming back to the UK, he started training in ophthalmology, which is eye surgery, but 10 months into his training, he quit to join the global management consultancy, McKinsey. He spent 3 years there in total, working closely in both medical and healthcare technology. But he then got a phone call from an old friend from medical school who was creating a startup. He asked Imran whether he could quit his job at McKinsey to start a telemedicine company. Imran said yes, and he was away on his journey to start his first business, which we'll talk at length about during this episode. He helped build the company for 2 years and left it about a year ago. Since then, he's been dabbling in YouTube and been doing freelance consulting and angel investing. But what was it that inspired Imran to quit his medical training, something he'd invested 10 years of his time in, to joining McKinsey?
I think there were some like longer term reasons that I had been brewing for a while, and then there were some triggers. So the longer term reasons were that with medicine, especially when you subspecialize, the perspective that I had at the time was that I was going into like a more and more niche part of more and more niche part of this field of ophthalmology. And I was basically going deeper and deeper down a kind of rabbit hole where I was becoming an expert, very much a kind of, what's the word? Almost like a musician or like somebody who basically does one thing to like a very deep level of expertise. Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't really get trained to like deal with a lot of breadth. That's not the focus of the job. The focus, especially in the UK, is around like high volumes of like relatively specific procedures. So you become a kind of master technician, and you have to be good with people and good at science and so on. But ultimately, that's what your intellectual journey is. I had this real sense that, like, given how quickly the world was changing around me, to put it into perspective, I landed in Oxford in 2005. That year, Facebook launched in the UK, and you still needed a university email address. 2 years later, the iPhone launched. Then Instagram, WhatsApp, you know, Twitter, all of these things like started to emerge and start to shape our lives in the way that they are now the fabric of like how we communicate and so on. That was happening around me. And I had this sense that as a medic, even with medical research as an analogy, like I felt like I would be the last person to be given the innovation because it has to go through like all of these commercialization, innovation steps, whatever it may be. So I had this, sense that like I wanted to get closer to where the interesting stuff was happening, and I didn't want to get left behind as a kind of like practitioner at the end of the food chain. That was one of the major reasons. The second was that I realized that medicine as a career in the UK, although medicine is kind of global, because of the regulatory and legal frameworks within which you practice, you can't just like pick up and travel. And I mentioned earlier, I grew up abroad. I've always enjoyed traveling, even as a medical student. So I felt like I would have to tie myself down. I sort of have to pick my like patch, you know, and start laying down foundations and then just establish myself. And I wanted more flexibility. I wanted to be able to work on problems in and related to medicine. Then the triggers were that shortly before I left, I had had a sequence of experiences in my residency, in my training program, my registrar specialist training, where I started to question, like, I'm giving all of my time and my energy, my weekends, like everything, literally my everything, to like this training program, and I didn't feel like a reciprocity from the system. When I say, I'm not talking about individuals, I'm just saying as a system. So like, you know, you work at Bain right now, so you probably work long hours, But every now and then, presumably you'll get taken out of your client situation, you'll get put in a classroom, you'll have like, you know, the very best people in the world in their network to come and like really spend time with you to teach you how to do stuff. You'll get tons of on-the-job apprenticeship. You'll get, you know, the ability to basically remove any practical roadblock from the delivery of value to your clients. Any, you know, it's about delivering the kind of intellectual output of your brain and moving all the other problems out the way. With someone to book your travel for you, take care of your logistics, drive you home, whatever it may be. That's a very privileged lifestyle. I'm not saying that, you know, that's like a reasonable expectation to have. But on that spectrum, I felt I was at the other extreme. I was like, you know, literally busting my gut.
Doing everything
I could. Exactly. And then like, you know, just having to like fight to, you know, like get some operating theater time. And I'm on a surgical training program. And that was really dispiriting. So I thought, look, you know, this will still be here. Let me take a gap year. And then in actual fact, I was told I couldn't take a gap year because I'd have to do like basically 2 years of training before I could pause my training. So I thought, look, you know, do I do this additional 15 months before I can take a gap year, or do I just take a gap year now? And a friend of mine, close friend of mine, said to me, the only reason, like after talking to me, said the only reason you would keep doing medicine is as a backup plan. So that was his diagnosis of my like thinking about it. He's like, this seems like a backup plan to you. So you've got this McKinsey offer. Stop like investing time in plan B. Just quit your program. Take the offer and make it work. Like make it succeed. And so that's what I did. So that was when I pulled the trigger.
You mentioned something there which is interesting in terms of the culture at medical school. Did you find it was very competitive? And I'm comparing it here to, let's say, your time at McKinsey. How did you find the culture was different in those two different environments?
There definitely was a bit of like competitiveness or a sense that there's like, you know, a few prizes to play for, whatever it may be, when it came to exam periods. I know for a fact there were some folks that dealt with that with some zero-sum tactics, if I can put it that way. And I include myself in that bucket from time to time, and it's not like a great thing. But I think in that type of like uber competitive environment, that those types of dynamics can emerge sometimes when there's something to play for. McKinsey, at my level of tenure, honestly, I never felt it was competitive. It was much more collaborative. Perhaps at the higher levels of tenure where there's like people fighting over clients and platforms, you know, within the company, then it can get more competitive. My experience was very collaborative. People generally like very open to have you work with them, to support them, to give you credit. In McKinsey, like people used to give a lot of credit to the people that did the work. I always found that really, really motivating, especially like if a boss mentioned something in public and said like, you know, big thanks to like the team and mentioned the people and what they did, like that was amazing.
And what kinds of projects were you working on when you were at McKinsey? Because I know you mentioned that you were interested in technology, and I know you did a bit of a rotation into Quantum Black as well for a few months. What was the nature of the types of cases you were doing?
Yeah, so when I went to McKinsey, I had no real ambition to work outside healthcare related stuff. I actually just wanted to do like medically relevant stuff. You said earlier, like, oh, you know, how did you make that decision to give up something you've been working for 10 years of your life? So when I went to McKinsey, I didn't think about it as giving that up. I thought about it as like, I built this foundation. Like I can read a medical paper. I understand the human body. I understand how to speak to doctors and patients. How can I build on that in an interesting way? So I saw my work as an extension of everything that had come before. So I only did what we called in McKinsey pharmaceuticals and medical products. But basically it was pharma, biotech, medical tech, medical devices. All the work I did was in that space. And I didn't actually do much healthcare, which in McKinsey parlance is like working for healthcare systems, like payer systems, like the NHS, working for hospitals. I didn't do much of that at all. The simple reason was I wanted to do commercial work, and a lot of the healthcare services work is more like organizational work, it's strategy work, it's about like, you know, setting up new services, whatever it may be, but it's not that commercial. It doesn't involve like the markets, it doesn't involve product development, you know, pricing, these types of things are not relevant.
And how did you find your life personally changed when you went from medicine into consulting?
So that was a big change. So the first thing was that we moved into London, having lived in Oxford. So I'd never actually lived in London up until then. So we lived in South London, and I was commuting every day, basically on a surface train and on a bicycle. So, when I was working in medicine, I was covering like five hospitals that could be in like an hour plus in every direction from Oxford. So all of a sudden, having gone from like driving literally all over the country, having to sit through traffic jams, I was now jumping on my bike every day and taking a 15-minute train from East Croydon into Victoria, and then like, you know, a 10-minute cycle. The other major change was that my weekdays were very busy, but my weekends were my own. So I would like have to prepare myself, you know, either to travel or to work long hours Monday to Friday. But then I could plan for my weekends. I could keep on my weekends. I could plan to have Christmas off every year, New Year's off. I had these additional opportunities to take like extended time off, which I did take. I had much longer paternity leaves, like 8 weeks, than what I was offered in the NHS. You know, obviously my pay went up. I think my hourly pay didn't change very much. It maybe changed like 15% per hour when I switched roles. Obviously, it went up over time to a lot more than that. And then, you know, the bonus culture, the pension and so on. So I still have like a significant pension that's growing every year, just based on what was accrued during those 3 years there. So yeah, lots of changes personally, and I think just a lot more like confidence to carve my own path. You know, people I think go through moments in their life where they have these like, they have these moments of realization where you can go from subconsciously making decisions that are, that seem, you know, they're basically like the consequence of like social constructs or expectations or whatever it may be. And then there are some times in your life where you make like a decision that might even surprise you yourself. And you think, oh gosh, like this feels like much more like an authentic and conscious and deliberate decision. So when I left medicine and went to McKinsey, on one level, that was like a kind of cliche thing for an Oxford graduate to do. But on the other hand, for me as a medic, it was like very, very conscious, very deliberately stepping off that treadmill. And so when I came to the end of my 3 years there, like I felt much more empowered to do what I wanted to do, because a lot of McKinsey people that leave McKinsey, you know, they go into jobs at corporates, they go into financial services jobs, they go to other consulting companies. It's quite unusual to see, especially in 2018, it was quite unusual to have somebody go into a 0-to-1 situation where you haven't raised any money. But that's exactly what we did. So I felt like empowered by that. And I've always since then tried to keep that alive, whether it was leaving my startup or whether it's like doing things like traveling as we are just now. You know, there are things that I just sort of try and really consciously think like, what do I actually want to do with my life? What am I interested and excited about? How should I be spending my time? What's important to me right now? And then just trying to lean into those decisions.
And you mentioned you then got a phone call from a friend of yours who was starting a company, and you decided to try and drop everything at McKinsey and move on to entrepreneurship startups. Why don't you just tell us a little bit more about how that worked and what you were asked to do?
Yeah, so this was an old friend, somebody I'd worked with as a medical student and I had known for about a decade. This is actually, incidentally, one of the reasons I think it's so important for people to do projects, for want of a better word, do projects at university. Because even if they're like, they seem silly at the time, or they seem like, you know, you're not going to spend the rest of your life doing that work, what you learn is like you learn what different people are like to work with in that type of work, like creating a project, getting an initiative off the ground, whatever it may be. You learn a bit more about yourself, how you work. And so in working with this friend of mine for a decade, I had realized I actually quite enjoyed working with him. Like, we were friends, but we were actually quite compatible from a work point of view. And so when he said that he wanted to start a tech company and he had an idea and he had a kind of way for us to get some funding, for me, that was tremendously exciting because, you know, it's sort of like, you can spin your wheels in the early days if you're like not quite sure what to do. There was still a ton to figure out though. And we had to kind of go through that journey together and raise money together and so on. But I just found that prospect of doing it with somebody familiar who I had worked with in the past, it just made it a lot easier. And so in the very first instance, what we were trying to figure out was like, how are we going to get some money to get this thing off the ground? The reason we had that problem was because neither of us was technical. We couldn't build the product. In hindsight, I do have different views on that now, but so we started raising money, and then we were able to raise some funding within a few months. And then we were able to sort of, you know, kick off product development and outsource some of it and so on.
And is that something you always wanted to do? Did you always want to go into entrepreneurship, or was it like, you know, outcome of the phone call you got, basically?
I had been thinking for a while about startups and the early stage investing space. So just before I left McKinsey in the Q4 of the year before, I left in like February, March of 2018. Before I left, I'd had my second child and I had an 8-week paternity leave, and I used that paternity leave to speak to a lot of people in the ecosystem. And I actually thought I wanted to do VC. So I interviewed for a VC job at like quite a good firm based in Holland, very good like healthcare investing company that grows a lot of their own partners, which is unusual in VC. And I actually had an offer to join them. So they put an offer on the table. I went there to visit the team, interviewed, got the offer. And I was like very, very, very close to signing it, especially because the people element of that job just seemed amazing. And then I had this feeling, which is that if I took this job in venture capital, as time went on, it would be harder and harder for me to leave just because of the way that economics usually work in these firms. It's the same as being a consultant, right? Like if you climb the ladder at Bain and you become a partner, all of a sudden the incentive to stay is much greater than it was at your stage now. So I thought to myself, like, okay, if I really want to take a risk and do the hardest and most developmental thing I can do in my career right now that I'm interested in doing, that's starting a company. If I don't do it now, it's going to get harder as time goes on. If I do it now and it doesn't work out, I've already got a job in VC, so I can probably get another job in VC because I just have to like back myself that I can do that. Or I could go back to McKinsey and I could like, you know, take some time, figure it out again. So actually, from a risk point of view, in absolute terms, the position I was in was not that risky. So I did the hard thing and started the company at that stage. But yeah, I would say it wasn't something like, I've not always thought I want to be an entrepreneur, but I have been increasingly aware of the like benefits of being an entrepreneur. There are many, many, many disadvantages. But there are a few tangible benefits, and they were enough to like, you know, make me think, right, this feels like a good thing to do.
Why don't we just dig a bit deeper? You mentioned obviously the benefits and the disadvantages. What are they? Because yeah, I don't know myself.
So the benefits of being an entrepreneur are that like, if you go through that process, if you build a product, if you raise money, if you build a team, if you start to build a business, many of the projects, the business projects that you and I have worked on as consultants, are taking businesses or mature products that have been through that early stage of that product development, and we're just like optimizing them in a later stage. Yeah, you're increasing their potential much further down the line. Now, the greatest innovations that have touched our lives in the recent past and where the most change happens is at that really embryonic early stage of building new products, building new businesses, innovating. There's a whole like host of benefits that happen there to the economy and to society. That's where new technologies come out. It's where new cures emerge for diseases. It's where, you know, like innovation in the climate space happens. It's where jobs are created, even in economic downturns, right? I'm not saying that big companies don't have their role. Of course they do, but many times, you know, often they're like just stable products that are being tweaked. And that type of challenge is very, very different to the early stage 0-1 challenge. If you can build 0-1 products and companies, and I still consider myself like an amateur at that and still learning how to do that, it's tremendously powerful and it can create tons and tons of economic and social value. So throwing myself into the gauntlet of learning how to do that for me was really attractive because it was just seemed very developmental. It was like, it's a really good thing to learn. Now, the other benefits that I now see are like going through that from an economic point of view as a founder. A lot of founders are like quite economically hard up in the early years. So I feel that being able to withstand that, having withstood that, or now knowing what that involves, and I can go through that again if I have to, that makes me resilient in a way that a lot of people who some people will make life decisions that make it very, very hard for them to leave their jobs, lifestyle inflation, golden handcuffs, whatever you want to call it. So I think going through that is like, it's a really resilient thing to do, resiliency building exercise to do. And then the final thing I would say is that It's also just a very good like real world education in business building and like what really matters in a business. Understanding cash flow, understanding how to work with customers, how to interview customers, how to innovate on products. Like you can learn stuff in an MBA, but going through all of that in real life, in a like live situation is just a really good like business training. So the downsides, I think the main things are it's quite lonely, it's got a high failure rate, people feel a lot of like anxiety and self-doubt. You know, failures and setbacks will happen like on a weekly basis. They can be really stressful. Taking other people's money, that's like a big responsibility. You know, building healthcare products for people that are sick, you know, systems carrying sensitive data and so on. These are all like quite challenging things to do. But yeah, that I don't know if that answers the question.
No, it does. And actually just wondering, curious, how did you said you get, you know, failures, challenges, setbacks on a weekly basis. You also get that in consulting, I guess, but to a slightly lesser extent, and you have less skin in the game, and it's, you know, less about you, it's more about the project you're doing. So the stakes are a bit higher, I think, when you're starting your own business. How did you personally deal with the challenges that you face on a weekly basis, you know? Because I can imagine mentally it must just take its toll on you to know that you have a family to support, and if something goes wrong, you suddenly are out of a job and your company doesn't exist anymore. How did you manage that kind of environment?
Yeah, and just on that point, like, you know, also your employees, you know, like they have families, they have dependents and so on, and they have challenges that they face in their life, like personal challenges, health, mental health challenges and so on, and you've got all of that somehow like kind of on your shoulders. So I don't think I dealt with it like perfectly. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs feel quite torn, you know, they feel that pain on a day-to-day basis, like they carry the burden and the anxiety within themselves, and they find ways to like bottle it up or release it elsewhere in constructive ways, hopefully. For me, like when I was at university, I started to build some habits personally, which when I look back now, 15 years, I think those habits actually really have helped me and do help me. So for me personally, like I've always tried to eat well. I've always tried to stay physically active, to exercise. And the one thing I could do a much better job of is sleep. I do tend to burn the candle at both ends, but those are two examples. Then thirdly, like family, before I got married and had kids, like my family were, you know, my kind of immediate nuclear family were super important to me. I spent a lot of time with family and friends. But then like having a young family, you know, that provides you with a different level of support. Okay, it is stressful in the sense that you have to provide for them and you have that responsibility. But there's no, like, you know, having, like, you know, when you bear a responsibility and you deliver when you have a responsibility, that itself becomes a source of, like, inner strength. So you feel, yes, I can do this. Like, you know, let's say you do something difficult at work. You have a lot of responsibility on your shoulders, and then you get through that project and you get positive feedback. Those experiences actually build, like, an inner resolve. So I think having these responsibilities is like a two-sided coin. I think having obviously a great co-founder and like team members around you, people to talk to, a peer support network, personally, like faith is an important part of my life. These things all give me like a little bit of they counterbalance the like, you know, ups and downs of, you know, day-to-day like stresses.
And what would you say was the hardest part when you were founding your company?
I would say that there's an existential anxiety you can feel until you become established as a product or as a business. And there's always going to be like a little bit of doubt in the back of your mind, which is what we're doing the right thing to be doing? Is it going to work? Like, are we going to succeed? Are we going to be able to raise money again? Are we going to become profitable one day? Just like having to sort of suspend judgment on all of those questions so that you can be effective in getting the day-to-day done whilst also seeing the big picture. Like, it's quite a lot to juggle in your head. That in particular. And then the second thing I would say, I know you asked me for one thing, but it's usually the people challenges, like products and the market and so on. Like, those things can also be solved. But sometimes you have difficult people challenges, which are tricky, and they can sometimes take the most time and energy.
Did you find your training at McKinsey helped at all in dealing with any of that? Or was a lot of it just trying to figure things out as you went along?
It's a mix. So McKinsey and consulting in general is an environment that I think primarily gives credence to IQ over EQ, right? So if you think about like your decks that you're building and your models and your like elegance of your analysis of a market and your competitive environment, whatever it may be, those are like intellectual outputs. You're not reading people. You're not like walking the corridors usually at you know, your level or a manager level, whatever, like really reading all the personalities and like playing the relationships and like trying to understand how best to get your agenda completed. So I think McKinsey is an IQ heavy place, and there are people with great EQ there, but I don't think I got like as much structured training or apprenticeship on that side of things. When you're running a business and you're dealing with people day to day, you're hiring, you're firing, you're working with customers, etc., like EQ is really, really important. So that was very much something I had to build on the job. But I think that the work ethic, I think that the skills around like analyzing a market and a product, an opportunity, digging into data, being like a rationalist when it comes to like, you know, data about your business, I think those things are incredibly helpful. And they definitely were skills that I learned at McKinsey.
And where did you raise money from? Because you mentioned a few times that you spent a lot of time with your co-founder raising money, reaching out to investors. How did that whole process work, and what was your role in that?
Yeah, so I had a very heavy role in all of our fundraising. So our materials, our pitch decks, our models, you know, those were documents that I basically owned in terms of like getting them investor ready. And then a lot of the capital that came to the company was through relationships that either like a venture capital fund, for example, that was the, you know, the investor on the investment team, who's on the board as well, was a medical doctor, McKinsey alum, that I was referred to via another McKinsey alum at a McKinsey reunion event. And then one of my old McKinsey partners made an investment, and a bunch of other colleagues with connections to the firm. So I think it was important. All those connections are very important, and that was a big part of what I did. So we did three fundraising rounds. The first one was a friends and family round, where we had like medical doctors who owned clinics, and then like connections, friends and family investing. The second round was where we got VC involved and more angels. Who were people who, like, for example, were healthcare entrepreneurs in a previous life. And then that was the VC fund that I mentioned earlier. And there was a second VC fund and then a partner from a third VC fund that also invested based on my previous connections. And then the third funding round was, yeah, more of like what happened in the second, just following on during the pandemic, almost like an extension of the second round. But it was about 3 or 4 times bigger. So, yeah, in total, it was angel investors, friends and family, and VC funds. And one of the VC funds was a strategic fund. So they were owned by a healthcare company.
Got it. And what exactly was, we haven't really talked about it, but what exactly was the product you guys were building?
Yeah, so my co-founder's vision for this was that, if you remember about 4 or 5 years ago, I don't know if you remember Babylon Health bursting onto the scene and sort of like, you know, popularizing this, this idea that you could see a doctor or a GP on your phone. So he had this sort of like view that eventually like all patients will be accessing their doctors on a mobile device. And so we basically built telemedicine tools. We didn't build the service, which means we didn't hire doctors and we didn't sell care through a platform like Babylon did, but we built the tooling that any doctor could use. So, you know, we basically gave that to NHS doctors to use with their patients. Over time, the business has become more focused on research. So instead of being used in like care delivery, like I need to speak to my doctor, so I'll do a video or a telephone call. Instead of that, it became more, you know, patient enters a clinical trial. And then in that research trial, they're having some of their touch points with the trial organizers. They're having them digitally, or they're sharing information digitally, or they're sharing their NHS medical data with the trial sponsor, that sort of thing.
Why did you said a year ago you left to become now YouTuber, advisor, investor. Why did you decide to stop on the startup journey, so to speak?
Yeah, so a few things changed. So the first thing is that, you know, when I set out to build this business in the early days with my co-founder, our focus was initially on healthcare. And a big part of my personal motivation as a medical doctor and in those early products where I was very involved in literally like deploying those products in the, with the very first users, like getting the first person to actually use the product, you know, developing the product through all the feedback and what have you. We pivoted, as I mentioned, late in 2020, this is like a few years, couple of years after we started, into life sciences, away from healthcare, away from building for doctors. So for me, that was like a really big part of my motivation. And then, you know, we sort of made a decision and that's the direction that the company went in. So a big part of my motivation had sort of like, we sort of moved tangential to that. A second part is that as time went on and we made that change, because we had scaled the product in healthcare in that first chapter, we now had a full product team, designers, product developers, product managers, head of product and so on. So my own role in building the product, like I wasn't needed there as much because we now had a full team to basically do that as we pivoted. So I started to do a lot of other like supporting activities, did the fundraise, you know, helping with like hiring, building out an engineering team, lots of the internal operations of the company and so on. So that set of responsibilities was like, again, not the kind of content that I had previously felt most excited about and most motivated to do. And then the third thing is that actually there was an opportunity to partially exit the business, which basically means that, you know, a partial exit is when somebody is given the opportunity to basically offload some of their shareholding. And it's called partial because it's some of your shareholding, not all of your shareholding. So there was a path basically for me to take some liquidity, or, you know, some chips off the table, if I can put it that way, but still retain a significant share of the company. So when that path arose, it basically looking at the how I was feeling about the work at the time and there are a few other factors and so on, I just sort of thought like, you know, this feels like a best of both worlds type option for me because I get some liquidity. I get to, you know, like I get to choose what I want to do now. I can sort of, you know, cut loose and go and paddle my canoe in fresh waters, if I can put it that way. But I also get to stay involved with the company. So it felt like, you know, a best of both type option.
Upon reflection, having founded and run a really successful company from basically zero to one, like you say, what do you think are the most important things for a founder to do for their business to succeed?
Basically, the first thing is that you need to build something that people actually want. Now, that sounds really obvious, but a lot of founders, and I include myself in this bucket, we built something that we wanted. Like we had an insight or a perspective on an opportunity, and we built something that initially we, to the best, our best judgment, was like the right thing to build. Now, what you really want to be guided by is your user, is your customer, and like how they use your product, what their behavior is around it, how they, you know, like, is it a problem that's really worth solving for them? Because in all of our lives, there are like small inefficiencies, small problems that somebody could come and solve for you. The truth is that unless that problem is a high enough priority for you, you will make do with the fact that the problem persists and you won't pay for a product to solve it. There's lots of things like that. You know, for example, in the pandemic, being able to exercise from home was a really big problem for people because gyms were closed. So products like Peloton that gave people that sense of like, you know, a proper workout without having to, you know, try and go to a gym because that wasn't possible, that was really important to them. As the pandemic has waned, I mean, there's lots of reasons for Peloton's downfall, but as the pandemic has waned and gyms and everything else have started to reopen, the acuity of that problem has reduced. Like people have now, it's like a nuisance maybe going to the gym, but it's not like something you can't do and maybe it has other benefits. So there's that sort of assessment that you need to make of the problem that you're solving. And many times people will spend a long time optimizing and solving their solution for a problem that's not a big enough problem for their customer. So it won't actually ever like take off in the way that they want because they're kind of doing a local optimization, not a global optimization, not solving like a major problem. The second thing is that
the whole product, it's the whole product market fit.
Yeah, that's what you're trying to get to. You're trying to get to, you know, like a really, really strong pull for your product and people willing to pay for it and so on. And I think, you know, even in hindsight, like we had a product that scaled very, very rapidly, but in its state that it was in, it wasn't solving a painful enough problem. So we couldn't commercialize it well enough, which is why we pivoted. The second thing I would say is that you need to be very, very frugal. And you need to learn as cheaply as possible, because the reason that, like, one of the main reasons that businesses shut down is because basically they run out of money and they can't, like, you know, carry out the next 5 or 10 bets that might lead them to traction and success. So you need to basically control your burn rate as a business in the early days, especially. The final thing I would say is that, like, a lot of founders get fixated on their solution. And I have, like, something that's really stuck with me is as an aphorism is like, treat your products as cattle, not pets. You know, people slaughter cattle all the time. You don't have an emotional attachment to a specific animal. But pets are totally different. Like, you don't want to hand your pet over to anyone. Like, it has a name. You stroke it every day. Like, you feed it, you nurture it, you love it. You have pictures of it on your phone. Like, don't treat your product like a pet. Treat it like cattle. And don't be focused on the solution, focus on the problem. Because if you focus on the solution, what happens is that it becomes very difficult to, like, go through the twists and turns and pivots you need to find out what's actually going to work. So those are some of the things I would say for people to bear in mind. And then ultimately, in the early days, like, we were very fixated on our ideas. Like, we wouldn't speak to people unless they signed an NDA. All of that is just nonsense. Like, at the end of the day, the thing that really matters for the vast majority of companies is execution. Your ideas are not really worth anything. You might think that because you spent a long time on your deck that your ideas are, like, precious, but they're not. Like, the thing that matters is, can you go and build the thing in the market? So you need to focus on that.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Final question I have, which I ask every guest who comes on the show, is if you were able to go back in time, speak to young Imran, maybe in high school, maybe just about to start his medical journey at Oxford, what advice would you have for him, having now been through what you've been through at McKinsey and at your startup and now your time as an advisor and investor?
I think that this is a huge question, and it's one that's not going to be very easy to answer, but I'll have a go. I'm sure if you ask me this on another day, I might come up with something slightly different. But at the moment, it feels like when you do hard things, when you take on challenging opportunities, that's often where a lot of the learning happens. So there's a type of person that might try and optimize their way through life by avoiding challenge. But there isn't much reward in that path. And although that might lead to financial reward, or it might lead to a sense of, like, having avoided what you might perceive as risk, the truth is that there's a much bigger risk in that, which is a sense of unfulfillment, or a sense of, like, you know, thinking that you're optimizing for something very safe by avoiding risk. But actually, you become very brittle in that regard, because you can't actually do much beyond maybe what you have committed to doing. I see a lot of people like that who will do the same thing for a very long period of time. I mean, it works for some people, but they're also, you know, the people that have learned the most and become the most flexible and adaptable and useful are, in my view, people that can build stuff, people that can withstand the stress and the chaos that happens at the frontiers of, like, what we know how to do as a society. And, you know, there is, like, there's a lot of personal development that happens there. There's a lot of sense of meaning and purpose that can come out of your work. Even if you think about flow states, right? If you've ever felt that sense of flow, like real focus on a problem, that sense that the time is passing, although it's hard and painful, you kind of enjoy it in a subtle way. That usually happens when you're doing something that's beyond your capacity, that's, like, harder than you think you can manage, and you're really having to apply yourself. So I think that for me has, like, been an approach in hindsight, as I look back, that's actually been quite rewarding, is to try and do hard things, to take on some risk, to put myself out there. Even with content creation as an example, like, every time I publish something, it feels a bit uncomfortable. The second thing I would say is that, you know, life is a marathon, not a sprint. When I started my medical specialization, I thought, oh my God, 7 years of specialization, that's going to feel like forever. If I had continued down that path, I would have finished like a year or two ago. I'm not saying that I should have done that, but for me, the last 10 years have gone quite fast. So even though something might feel long, actually, I think people should have long planning horizons, not planning horizons, but they should have a long horizon in terms of like skills development, building expertise, and they should think of it as a marathon, not a sprint. And by that, I mean, you know, you need to, in the marathon, you have to stay well nourished, well hydrated. You don't want to like, you know, like injure yourself. You need to warm up, you need to warm down. So I think that type of thinking is really important. And part of it is also thinking about health and well-being in a holistic way. You know, I'm getting to the point now where there are a lot of friends of mine who are in their mid-30s who have neglected their health or well-being, or just got unlucky in some way, or something has happened. And so, you know, you need to really look after your health and well-being as much as you can. I think it's incredibly important, mental health, emotional health as well. The last thing I would say is that when people have successful careers, it's very rarely a linear up and to the right. Sometimes it is, but the most like breakout careers, they have inflection points where things are going linearly, but then they get like a real change in their trajectory because it's usually because they've done something exceptional or unusual. So just always be like attentive to that. Like, what is going to be your breakout moment? If you're looking for a career that gives you that type of return, where is that breakout going to come from? It's probably going to come from doing something unusual, not the kind of the things that you do every day, but taking a risk, reaching out to someone, pulling the trigger on something, or it's going to come through your network in an unexpected way. So look for those breakout moments because they won't come through linear progression.
That was Imran on today's episode of Seekers of the City. If you like the show, please remember to like our Facebook page and follow us on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening in, and I'll speak to you next time.